You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
Do you want to start or shall I?
Go ahead. Go for it.
No, I'm nervous now. I'm not sure how we should start. This is...
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, just kind
no,
of...
No, I'll start. What was that, Jake, where they
find
say...
Find that key, inner strength.
What is the key to comedy?
A little
timing.
Bit of truth.
Timing. So that's great. Listen, I just want to welcome you with open arms, Martin Saints, to the Hooked on Startups podcast. From the bottom of my heart, I mean, welcome to everything that I can offer, which is very little, I can tell you.
There you go.
Let me just, I'm just...
Well, you know, you got to bring humor to the startup process. That's
if only we could. If only we could find humor in the desolate wasteland that is the curse of the entrepreneur. So you are a cursed entrepreneur, I believe, from what I've read. In other words, it looked like you had a proper job and then decided one day that you're going to throw away all that sense of security and go and fend for yourself and build your own empire.
Yeah.
Or is that completely untrue?
Yeah. Build an empire as I perceived it at the time. And so
when did you start? When did you sort of make the leap, as it were?
When I got fired from my corporate job.
It's funny that, yeah. So it's funny that so many people say, well, I took this conscious decision to follow the path of an entrepreneur. So you mean you got fired? Well, yeah, I did get slightly fired, but that had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, there was like a new management regime. It was a corporation and they just didn't like me. They had their own people and I just was really bad at politics. And so they managed to do their thing and got me out the door. And that was one of the happiest days of my life.
Have you ever watched The Office?
Yes.
Because it was originally a UK series that they sort of brought over here as they did with me, obviously, as you can tell from the accent. But I mean, having been an entrepreneur for like, I know, in my case, you know, long time, you watch the episodes of The Office and you're just cringing just thinking, because every time I used to go to meetings as an, you know, I had my own business, and as an entrepreneur you go into these offices and you would see exact replicas of what the, so do you find that now that you have your own thing and have had for decades, when you actually meet people and you go into these office environments?
Yeah I think, you know, it's interesting. I kind of look at it from a different perspective now. So when I go in and I meet a business owner and they have a whole operation with employees, I have a great deal of respect for what they've built. And then when I meet like a struggling entrepreneur that's a solopreneur kind of working out of their house and they're still kind of struggling trying to do everything themselves instead of kind of hiring out and using economies of scale with labor. So I kind of look at it in different ways. But
I think it's the
I don't go into too many corporate offices.
I know it's the big corporates. That's the place that to me is hell on earth. The sort of, you know, the scary faceless, as you mentioned at the beginning, this idea that you have to be good at politics first and then maybe good at your job second.
Yeah. There's lots of conference calls and just lots of emails, lots of activities that don't drive true value. I view that in corporate America. And there's just lots of initiatives that don't necessarily translate to the mission of the organization.
Exactly.
So, anyway, we
digress. I mean, I wanted to find out much more about what led you towards note investing. So what were you doing before when that wonderful day happened, and what drove you to what is actually quite a complex, relatively unknown, even as a big business, it's still, you know, very much cloaked in sort of complication and regulation, and you know, it's not an easy business to get involved with.
I would just say that, you know, prior to getting fired, I was doing a lot of reading in my off time on books. There's this author in particular named Ty Hicks. And he just wrote about how you can have a side hustle doing a variety of different business models. And so I was always kind of curious about things, but when I got fired, I went into a whole deep dive into education, into reading Robert Kiyosaki books, going to real estate seminars. So I had definitely gone all in on a full-time level to just not repeat getting another corporate job.
But that's really difficult to transition, though, from just going to real estate seminars, reading books, and actually taking, you know, that rather large leap into actually doing something yourself. Because, I mean, how many people have you met over and over again go to the same seminars and actually spend fortunes on these sort of educational classes, but never actually get their feet wet?
Yeah, it's just, it's, there's a sea of those individuals that, you know, are where they're buried beneath. And it's just, you know, it's a tough journey just in your own mind. Forget about, you know, what business model to do, how to build a customer base, how to deliver a product, and just fighting your own mind on a daily basis where you have self-doubt, you have negativity, you have the I can't do this kind of syndrome. And so you go to seminars and it's the shiniest object, right? It's who presents the best that can kind of sell you on what they can do for you. And at the end of the day, you find that only you can do for you, right? I mean, other people can kind of help you, guide you, and give you partial roadmaps. But at the end of the day, it's got to be something you find within yourself. That you get rock bottom, you get sick of it, you get sick of your circumstances, you know that there's something better, you know that you're meant for something bigger, and just kind of forge ahead with whatever.
But I think, I know the first bit I agree with, but it takes some real something to be able to actually step out of that environment and not just, you know, sort of bump along the bottom. So, and that's the real... The first step, I mean, the hardest thing is finding, first of all, in my case, it's always been, you know, what am I going to do? In other words, you need to find something that you really believe in, that you're really interested in. I'm just curious, what led you to notes, or what led you to, was it the fact that it was, there's sort of non-tangibles, as it were, where you're not physically moving product around? Was it the mathematics, which is, you know, magical in some respects, or what was it that caught your imagination?
Yeah. So I kind of have a slightly different opinion. I understand the popularity or the thought process and kind of finding out what you love and doing that because you have some passion behind it. From my perspective, kind of what I've learned is been, you have to look for what there's a market for. And that should really kind of drive. And then you learn to love whatever it is you're doing that's kind of, you can build a big business around. In terms of, you know, what was your question again? I'm sorry.
I have absolutely no idea. Don't worry. The question really was, what made you make that decision? In other words, drove you?
Yes.
Now, you're absolutely right to pick up about this received wisdom that you need to follow your passions, because I think that's BS, frankly.
Yeah.
And it is a road to ruin where you turn a hobby into a business, you know, and you just waste all your and lose all your money. But so it sounds like it was a very strategic decision based on supply, demand, needs, you know, a real business. So that's...
Well, it was two parts. So service to others. Well, you know, we buy mortgages across the United States. Oftentimes the borrowers are in default and they haven't made a payment in a few years. So we're able, because we purchased those assets at a discount, we're able to help the homeowner get back on track with a payment plan. And we're able to make certain concessions to work with them financially. So there's a good service that's provided for homeowners across the United States. But also it's very lucrative if done correctly. So it's kind of a two part.
So you've got two sides of the equation. So you're moving into notes. And again, let's sort of follow the journey here. So you start off sort of scientific research, basically, as opposed to gut feel, which is always the best way. You know, this is the business I'm going to be in. How do you make your first deal? You know, do you just leap in, or not, you know, not leap in, but how did that happen?
To answer that, honestly, I just think that one, if one's going to jump into an opportunity, whatever that opportunity is, they need to go at it big time, or don't do it at all. So I'll give you an example. When my wife and I started our government contracting company, we sold museum exhibit displays to the federal government. So these are things that you would see in museums, and the federal government buys those. So we started out of the gate. We could have sold to every mom and pop business up and down the street, and we would have chipped away at the rock. But we said, no, we're going to sacrifice a few years to go and sell to the largest customer in the world. It's so kind of starting with the end in mind, starting big picture is going to help anyone kind of build to that. And so when I started buying mortgage loans, I said, I'm not just going to go and buy onesie twosies. I said, I want to buy on a large scale in the secondary mortgage market, which is really where a lot of the pools of these mortgages are purchased and sold.
And that's great, but that's actually quite difficult to do. So that takes two parts of the equation. I mean, you need obviously capital on one side, which is investors, and on the other side, you need the supply. So, and when you're starting out, as you absolutely, you know, rightly mentioned, you can either, you sort of start small and build up, but that's a real chicken and egg situation, particularly for real estate investment. You've either got too many deals and not enough money, or you've got too much money and not enough deals. And so how do you bridge that gap?
So, I would suggest that starting with forging strategic partnerships. So understanding, yes, supply is key, right? You have to have something to acquire, right? You know, or you have no business. And if you don't have any capital backing the acquisition, then you don't have a business there too. So as a starting point, someone should be focused on building their identity, understanding how they're going to be perceived in the space, and kind of building a marketing brand around that, and spending daily concentrated efforts on developing strategic partnerships in that industry. And from there, only good things can happen.
And you, again, I agree with you. This whole idea about sort of concentrated effort, you know, on a daily basis. I mean, this idea that it doesn't just happen overnight. You know, it is this process of attrition and osmosis, but also of, you know, that it is a time-honored challenge, really, for real estate. How do you get your first investors? And what advice would you give people just to get the ball rolling? You can build strategic partnerships, but a lot of those people don't do anything. You need to catalyze that first transaction. So what is the best path forward for people that are starting out trying to build their own real estate funds or portfolios, or do something like you on a large scale? How do you start?
You start with education. So in any business environment, there's always the fundamentals. And so I wrote a whole book called Note Investing Fundamentals.
Ah, and it's not actually true. You wrote 5 books.
Yeah.
It seems. And we'll come onto those shortly.
But this book in particular is close to my heart because it really touches on the fundamentals of what you need to have in place in order to begin sourcing deal flow and begin, you know, advancing yourself in the space. So a focus on education is critical. You know, everyone kind of jumps to the sexiness of, let me buy this, let me raise money here. And that's all, like, you know, because it's sensationalized, right? That whole idea, I'm going to be a wheeler and dealer. But unless you have daily discipline, whereby you're building the fundamentals through self-education, that's really sexy to me. And if you can do that, then along with a concentrated effort of outreach for strategic partnerships, then opportunities are going to start to find you. And I can tell you that the best place to find capital is from industry players within the industry you're operating. So in other words, if I'm a soon to be note investor and I'm self-educating and I'm doing all the right, putting all the right pieces together from a fundamental standpoint, and I stumble upon a deal, then I should try to line up capital from another player in the industry for that deal, because that other player can be much more than a capital partner. They could also be, you know, they could also help with underwriting. They could help with packaging the negotiations. They can help with asset management.
There's obviously a lot of steps involved. I mean, is this the sort of business that you would recommend to someone who wants to build their own business in real estate?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, it's a very tight-knit community, right? So you're going to have, you know, you're going to have challenges that way, but you have challenges in any industry. If this sounds like something for you, in that, you know, you feel like you can work with homeowners, you can negotiate, you can create daily disciplines for sourcing and building your identity and so forth. Yeah, by all means, you know, start for yourself. But I would just say that there's no room for mom and pops in our industry. You have to be fully committed to build out an operation with a team, maybe not from day one, but that should be a short-term goal for yourself.
Yeah.
Because there's compliance, there's other components to our industry.
And let's get a bit more into detail in terms of, you know, what is involved. So you were to describe simply what note investing is, how would you do that?
Yeah. So I think the best way to put it is that you have an individual that's looking to take out a mortgage on a home. And so they're going to go to a bank and they're going to apply for a mortgage. And at the closing table, they're going to sign a promissory note to promise to pay back the money given a certain set of terms. And then they're going to sign a mortgage or deed of trust that's going to tie that promise to the property in the form of collateral. So from that point, you're going to have some of those mortgages that are held on the bank's books to go into default. The borrower is going to stop making payments for whatever reason. And so that financial institution is going to bundle those defaulted mortgages into a pool and is going to sell them off into the secondary market. So my company buys those loans from the secondary market that are defaulted, but BeQuest Funds, my income fund, buys performing mortgages from that same secondary market as well.
Okay. And so you're buying those at a discount, presumably.
Buying both non-performing and performing. So if you take a mortgage that's in default and it gets sold for 25 cents on the dollar from a bank sells it for 25 cents on the dollar to the secondary market to a hedge fund, that hedge fund gets it to perform. And then that mortgage gets seasoned again, then it can get sold. BeQuest will buy that into our fund for 70, 80 cents on the dollar. And so the hedge fund benefits financially, and BeQuest receives a 20, 30 year cash flow stream by which we can pay our investor payments.
And what, you know, one of the questions that you hear a lot is, why would the banks sell those off at a discount? Why would they not just go through the foreclosure process, get the property, sell the property, and make more than 25 cents on the dollar?
First of all, they're not in the real estate business and they're not very good at it. And their hands are tied in terms of creative solutions that they can employ with the borrowers. So when that paper gets defaulted over a period of time, it actually gets kicked out of a securitized portfolio bundling. So it's no longer government backed. So from a bank's perspective, oftentimes they will charge off that mortgage internally, and then they're just going to want to recoup as much as possible by selling that mortgage off into the secondary space so they can resume doing what they're good at, and that is lending.
And so you've got like a two-stage process, it seems. So the first stage is where you're picking up non-performing notes, getting them back on track. Then you've got that more secured, seasoned revenue stream, which you can then put into your fund, which generates cash flow effectively. Now, do you deal with first position mortgages, seconds, combination of the two, or just
combination of the two? Yes. And, but a heavier focus on the junior liens on the second.
So mortgage. That's the seconds. So those are the mortgages that tend to be forgotten by the homeowners and, you know, where the dust is swept under the carpet. And I guess
the
one of the
two, you would be, the first as well.
Until it's too late, presumably, when you come along. And so what sort of reaction do you get from homeowners when you phone them up or write them a letter and say, I'd like to introduce myself or my company. You know, we are now the proud owners of your second position mortgage.
You get a variety of reactions. You know, everyone's different. In some cases, we have people that are very thankful that, you know, they didn't know who to connect with. They have their job back that they lost a few years prior and they're in a stable place. So they're looking to get caught up so that at some point they can pay off this obligation. And then you get others that, you know, want to avoid the whole subject of the debt obligation. And then you get, you know, other people that are a little bit more confrontational. You kind of get all of them. But at the end of the day, what we emphasize here is to treat everyone with compassion. We treat all the borrowers as customers and because by definition, they're paying us. They're paying our bills. They're paying our wages. So we want to treat them as customers with the utmost respect. And so we feel like if we stay true to who we are and how we need to come across with the borrowers, then only good things will happen as a result.
And I guess everyone is different. Every mortgage, every loan has a story behind it. And then you mentioned earlier about compliance and regulation, and you know, how much flexibility do you have to deal with these people, and what is the level of compliance that is involved in this type of business?
Sure. So we work with a licensed servicer. So this licensed servicer will send out the monthly loan account statements. They will accept payments and handle all the ledger accounting. They will send out the year-end tax statements. So from a servicing standpoint, we're always ensuring that we keep in compliance. Now, as it relates to certain states, there's various debt collector licenses. There's other, you know, kind of regulatory certifications that you have to go through. So we're conscious of that from a state by state basis. And we kind of work to ensure we have one individual that's in charge of compliance for the company. So we place heavy emphasis on compliance.
And do you think that with all of the 4 million plus mortgages that went into forbearance as a result of the CARES Act, that there's going to be this tidal wave of defaults, or how do you think the banks are going to deal with, and the servicing companies in particular, how are they going to deal with the sort of obligations that's on their shoulders now?
Yeah, so the CARES Act deals with government-sponsored mortgages, so Fannie and Freddie-backed mortgages. When we purchase mortgages in the secondary market, they actually don't fall under the CARES Act. But with that said, we're very conscious of kind of keeping in practice with how the CARES Act's unfolding. And as you know, and this whole thing is still evolving, right? But what I'm understanding and what I believe to be the case is that a majority of the mortgages that are in default or have a forbearance program associated to them, the lender will place the past due interest arrears on the back of the loan,
sure,
not accruing any interest to be paid upon payoff. So it'll give the homeowner a fresh start.
So that's the sort of the overall environment. So we talked earlier about the supply side, which is where you get the notes from, and the buy side, which is the investors. What type of investor profile typically would be your average investor?
We work with accredited investors, and you know, our ideal investor is someone who has monthly bills It's just simply put. So we're an income fund whereby people invest, accredited investors invest in our fund. We pay an 8% or a 9% annual return, and we make our payments monthly. So anybody who is accredited and has monthly bills, is, you know, they're a perfect client for us, because our whole objective is to help deliver passive income to those individuals that cover their monthly bills, plus also pads their pockets to meet any financial aspirations that they have.
So it's a good business to get into from a number of areas. First of all, it's attractive to investors because it produces a fairly solid yield. Now, you're collecting that from a large number of homeowners, so you're not concentrating your assets in, or your risk in any one particular place. How many people do you think it takes? I mean, so what's the sort of size of team that you think you need to run a the sort of business that you have?
So our team right now is 8 individuals. It's a $50 million income fund. We also have the other side of the business that works with the non-performing loans. So, you know, it's an interesting thing in terms of, you know, how many people we'll need to hire to achieve the goals that we're looking to go to. And we're looking to strive to $100 million operation in the next few years. So if that means we have to double the team size, you know, so be it. We understand the value. We appreciate the value that a good employee that, you know, can bring to the organization.
And there's a whole set of challenges in that. Yes. Just
oh, yeah.
terms of finding the people, but from a, sure. from a startup but perspective,
I'll take that. I'll say this. I'll take that over working out of my closet as yes. a one person show, doing everything myself.
But I think that, there are a number of people that are still, you know, obviously there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people who want to get involved in real estate investing. And knowing everything that you know now, and you mentioned earlier that this is not something that you can start as a mom and pop or with that aspiration, but can you start this business? Will you sell one or two notes to someone who says, look, you know, I've got a certain amount of capital. I want to buy a note from you, and I want you to teach me how to sort of work it out. Can people do that? Can you work with people, help them build a business where they're sort of half investor, half, you know, not employee, but almost like they're working with you? Is that something that you can see happening?
Like a cohort program or what have you. I can tell you that, you know, we hold some mastermind groups. We have one coming up in the beginning of June. And I do mentorship with only a couple people every 6 months. So literally like maybe 2 to 3 people at most. And I don't have anyone currently, so I'm actually kind of a little enjoying
this first.
A little bit. But you know, truth be told, it's not, I need to understand that they're serious and committed. I'm not at the point I'm at in life. I don't need the money if it comes with aggravation. You know, I want to make sure it's more significant than the money. I don't mind building someone up that I see could be a strategic partner with me, and we could do deals and we could grow together. I'm all for that. But if it's just a matter of, you know, trading time for training, I'm not interested.
Sure. That takes us back to the beginning, which is the, you know, the people that love these types of courses. But so as a business, as a, you know, or as a way into real estate, this sounds like it's an opportunity. It sounds like it's a way, you know, if you can buy one note, there's nothing better in terms of learning than learning by doing. You know, if you're able to work with people and, you know, so would you say, is this a business that you would recommend to someone who says, I want to get involved in real estate investing. I'm willing to roll my sleeves up, you know, put the work in. If I buy a note, I'm going to learn an enormous amount, in the same way that if I buy a house and try and do a fix and flip, I'm going to learn really quickly. Is that how you started? And is that how you would recommend people should get going?
Yeah, I started with buying 10 mortgage notes for $240,000.
And where did you get them from?
There was an online platform called FCI Exchange. They're no longer functioning right now. But there's some online marketplaces, PaperStack and I think Loan MLS. There's a few online exchanges that sell mortgage notes today. But to answer your question, if someone's really going to commit the time and energy, this is not as capital intensive as one may think. Yes. If you're going to put in the work, the more work you put in, the less of your own capital you'll need.
Is that because you can revolve the capital? Because if you can buy a note, and I presume that there's a ready market for people that want to buy performing notes. So does that mean you can make your capital work more efficiently?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, many people start the business by buying non-performing, get the notes to perform, and then flip the note just so they can recapitalize. And that's a really good strategy. It's not a long-term strategy, which is kind of why we created BeQuest Funds, because it's a legacy play. We want to experience all 360 monthly payments made by the borrower.
I think that's passive investment, isn't it? So from the active investor, I mean, you can get quite excited about the fact that, you know, let's say I've got a little bit of capital. I want to be a real estate investor. So you mentioned that there's a number of platforms where I could buy my first note, and then I can learn, as you say, which is the self-education process that you were talking about earlier. So I learn by doing. What sort of regulation, and I know you did touch on this, but
I would say they need to start with training, though. They training in the fundamentals before they buy their first note. So
and that's where your book was a great start.
Just a few months of just intensive immersion into the process. So they have some sense of what they're doing before they go out and buy a few training notes. And my recommendation would be to buy very small principal balance loans to practice on, so you don't get busted out, you know, with large dollar amounts. But I'll give you
the regulatory burden. You mentioned obviously that you've got a compliance team, but as a buyer, presumably I can buy a note. Do I need to be regulated, or is there a compliance burden for me just to buy a note?
Well, it depends on the state. So if you're in Georgia, you know, there's a state mortgage license that you need to have in place, or you can face a hefty fine.
Just to buy a note, presumably.
Just to buy a note. Yeah. But if you're in Texas, you're fine. So at this point that we're talking here,
that's
so
where the education
everything's changing,
critical.
Right?
Yes. You need to know things like that. I mean, that's sort of showstopper stuff. You know, so there's a real importance there.
But I'll say this. I do want to say this. So we foreclose less than 2% of the time for our entire non-performing portfolio, which is crazy, because our average length of default period is about 4 years. So we end up working out terms. We're very good. We have a lot of finesse. We have a lot of compassion. And so imagine that if there's 100 loans, let's just take as an example, and only two go to the auction block.
Yeah.
And at that auction block, you have 20 or 30 real estate investors. They're feeding off the crumbs.
Yes. And that's something that I've always understood about this type of market, is that it's very difficult actually to become part of the inner circle. Hedge funds won't talk to you until you've got momentum. So it is difficult.
So I'm a hedge fund. I'm talking to you.
Well, yes, but yes. But you know what I mean? As an investor, though, the larger the institutional players that are selling tapes of notes, you know, they're not going to entertain calls from someone that says, okay, I know you've got $100 million worth to sell, but do you mind selling me $25,000 worth? So yeah. that's one of the challenges. But also, what made you sort of, did you always have the intention to have a fund? Because that brings its own set of challenges, you know, because you've got passive investors. And was that part of the game plan? Or because that's sort of moving closer to being, you know, because when you have investors, then you've got a lot of people that you have to answer to. So that tends to sort of changes the dynamic of an entrepreneurial relationship.
So when I express about mom and pops working out of someone's closet, I'm speaking from someone that did this for the first four years, primarily out of a Starbucks. So I worked at, you know, I'd have my headset on, I'd be plugging away. A bar would call me and I would step outside and I would talk to, or if it was really cold, I would go into my vehicle and have a conversation. So I'm speaking from that perspective. So I get that. And when I published Note Investing Made Easier, my first book, it brought me out into the limelight. I actually enjoy, this is not the person you're talking to now is really not the person. I think me, I'm the person that just wants to be alone and just plugging away, doing my own thing in my own cave, and I'm happy. And so, but no, the books brought me out. And so it brought, and then it, but it brought other opportunities, and it brought people that wanted to mentor under me. And then it brought new opportunity deal flow. So now I kind of see the other side of it about building an operation, but I didn't have that vision initially. So that's where, if I could do it again, I would have started with the end in mind, large $100 million fund. How do I build to that?
Yeah. So I think that tends to be the case where people start out with the desire to work with people and investors and realize that, you know, that the smaller investors tend to have the louder voices, and it's like an inverse proportion rule. You know, the more you, the less you invest, the louder your, the louder your voice is. But
that's all Facebook. That's you just summed up Facebook.
Well, yeah, it is. An enormous amount of noise. Exactly. And your government contracting business, is that something that you're running as well? Or is that, because that in itself is a fascinating, you know, strategy, trying to break into, you know, what must be again an incredibly complex, layered, compliance driven marketplace.
Yeah, so my wife and I sold that company in 2013, but at some, you know, point in time, I had written a book on it, Secrets to Winning Government Contracts.
Yes, yeah, so I was just saying, have you got five books here?
And Matthew, that's the best selling book. Everybody wants to know how to sell to the feds.
Secrets to Winning Government Contracts. I think the clue is in the title, but that's so. How active are you with mentoring, mastermind? You mentioned that you do a couple of guys, you know, every few months, but are you growing that sort of training side of the business to bring more people into this type of this industry?
I'm scaling it back, actually. So when the book came out, I had people just flocking to me daily, you know, hey, can I take a training class? Can I mentor? Can I this and that? And so I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to say no to money. And so I started bringing the money in, and there was a point in time, maybe about a year and a half down the road. And my wife's like, you're not buying as many notes as you used to, and you need to think about that. And I was like, yeah, I do. And because the notes are the long-term play.
Well, that's the foundation, isn't it? That's your long-term hedge, as opposed to the short-term capital. So I guess even though you are an absolute expert in the field, the concept of running these sort of classes and masterminds, presumably there's a lower hanging fruit, or there's an easier way to make a living.
Yeah, the money's quick. I mean, you know, I throw out a training class and it's $2,000 and 10 people sign up in a couple of weeks with some email blast. And then, you know, you're putting some money in your pocket. You didn't have to, you know, put a few $100 out for a hotel room or whatever. And
yeah, but you do have these sort of 15 years of experience behind it that allows you to do that. So it's not.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's no fluff. I mean, like when I do so this was the other thing. I had been to so many seminars. I knew what fluff looked like.
Yeah.
And I knew what, you know, I knew what it looked like where someone's holding back the nugget until you sign up for the next level. And I got that whole scam. And so when I did the training, I actually did the opposite. When I do the fundamentals training, I haven't done one in a while, but when I do it, I give them so much content. I give them my whole operation that it's oozing out of their ears, and they need me. Like, they're like, I can't do this alone.
It's funny.
I need the B&B Quest funds. I need to, you know, will you mentor me? And so I took the opposite approach.
Yeah. And that's, again, I've seen that as well. And I think that's absolutely the right way to do it, where you sort of drip feed people in the expectation that they're stupid and that they, you know, don't figure out what you're doing, hoping that they'll come back for more.
Yeah.
But that attracts entirely the wrong people. And ultimately that's a road to ruin, because you just end up with very, you know, disgruntled customers.
Oh yeah. $79 for this course. And then next one's $250. And then,
yes,
you know, oh, it's like a breadcrumb trail to nowhere. It's horrible. And
you just end up with, you know, disenfranchised, upset customers who haven't actually learned anything.
Yeah.
Or you fire hose them with, look, this is the reality of the deal. This is what it actually takes. Here's, you know, 20 years experience in 4 hours, fasten your safety belt. And people realize then that actually this is quite a complex business, but it, you know, it is one of those businesses that I still really like, and I would love to get started into it, because it is appealing from so many different levels, from a, you know, purely from a, just exercising your mind, the mathematics, the complexities, the structuring, and the fact that you are enabling people to stay in their neighborhoods, and there is that impact.
Do you know why you should come into the node industry? I'll tell you.
Thank you, please. Yes.
because people are leaving in droves.
And why is that?
Because there's a whole cleansing that's going on with all the mom and pops, where there's just no inventory on the retail level. And they didn't build a business that's scalable, and they're just getting busted out. They're not equipped to handle node investing in today's environment.
That's right. Because when I looked at this years ago, it was dominated, or there were significant numbers of very small operators, single, you know, guys that would do maybe 10 or 15 nodes a year, something like that. So you're saying that's all gone now? Or going?
Well, there's individuals that are still kind of running around with 10, 15 notes, and you would swear they had a PhD and they're on Facebook, you know, telling you what you need to do, because they know so much, and they're spending more time on Facebook than they are in the actual process of their company. But there's opportunity here. So my partner, Sean Munyo, he's my first protege. So he actually reached out after I launched the book, and I mentored him for 6 months. And so we later became partners. So that kind of speaks to, look, if you are someone that's diligent and focused and willing to put in the time, then eventually you will get accepted in this circle.
Yes.
And you will work yourself in.
Yeah. And I can see that. And it, as it is a small group, there's probably no time for trying to educate people that come in. You know, it's you've got to come in with chops, with credentials, with something.
At least an identity, right? And a willingness to learn and to be genuine. I mean, that's kind of like just one, you know, being a human 101, you know, go to a conference and just say, hey, look, you know, I'm new. I'm willing to learn, and I'm just absorbing, and, you know, next time I see you next year, Martin, you know, we're going to do something together.
Yes.
And so just being that person that's just hitting the books every day, and you'll eventually find your way through.
Good. And so they're still very much active. People are, you know, the books, what book would you recommend out of the books that you've written, to be the best starting point for people that want to find out more about, you know, this industry?
Yeah. Node Investing Made Easier. I think it's just a good starting point. In that book, I wrote about the sourcing life cycle, which still I believe is applicable today. And that is how someone starting their journey through building a note business, and starts with building their identity. Then it breaks into marketing and branding efforts, then daily outreach efforts, then how they're going to operate on social media. And there's do's and don'ts with that. And then tapping on deal flow and transacting on that deal flow, and then allowing that cyclical process to snowball itself.
Yeah. Well, fascinating. Good. So another question, completely different. So what do you do in your spare time? So when you're not up to your neck in notes, what are the weekends have in store for you?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, you know, they're very different than the weekdays. And I have four children, eight and under. So when I'm not making babies, I'm going and taking care of babies.
No. It's like, but, I mean, it's a full-time job, you know, just look, I have the same, you know, sort of situation. You know, just, but we're doing, what do you do the weekends? I've got four kids. Oh, okay. I got it. You know?
Yeah. You know, we're doing like activities. I love just doing, very, you know, nature walks and trails. We're always having activities. We'll go to the beach. We'll rent out a boat, go on the water, and just make it like really fun for the kids. During the weekdays, I don't see them as much. I'm kind of just I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and then I'm off, and they see me kind of around dinner time usually.
Yes. Yeah. That's, and you don't work at home. You work in an office, presumably with your, yeah. So that's that's tough with the younger kids.
Yeah. My wife has stayed home, you know, since they were little.
Managing director younger. Of the Saints household.
Yeah. So, I mean, I hang out with you and you're agreeing with me and you're all just kind of, and I'll go home and I'll get some direction. Yeah, <that's, laughs> like, exactly. You know, you could have done this better, blah, blah. which is in a constructive way.
But brilliant. Good. Well, it's now we're moving on to the rapid questionnaire section. Now, if you haven't received the questions, so here we go. My Hooked on Startups quickfire questionnaire, which I shamelessly stole from James Lipton. Well, I changed a couple of words, so you can't sue me. I say that every time. I just hope, you know. All right. I can see you sort of, you know, stretching.
Let's do it, Matthew. You know, I'm ready.
Looking for the neck crack. Okay, so Martin Saints, question number one. What is your favorite word?
Cash flow.
Ah,
even though it's two words,
it's one. No, we'll make it one. See, we have the right to do whatever we want here. We can, you know, English is a living, breathing language. There you are. Number two, what is your least favorite word?
Laziness.
Multisyllabic answers. I like it. Number three, what are you most excited about right now?
Building a legacy for my family. And being a model for my kids.
Mm. And number four, what turns you off right now?
I'd say complacency. Yeah, just lack of productivity, lack of advancement.
No, I know. Again, yeah, I'm that sort of walking through molasses feeling. Number five, what sound or noise do you love?
We have a success bell here at the office. It's rang every time. It's like a Navy bell. It's rang every time someone does something successful. And I just love hearing it. We all come out and clap and congratulate the individual. So I love hearing that. And I love hearing my kids play piano.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't like mine. It's just always a noise. Number six, what sound or noise do you hate?
My 8-year-old makes a screeching sound. I don't like it. He does it just kiddingly, but I don't like it.
It's just, yeah. Well, the other answer to that question is other people's kids learning to play the piano. Question number seven, what is your favorite curse word?
I generally don't curse. You'll find that I it's very rare. I don't curse. And I don't have a favorite one.
Did you just sit there and your face sort of goes bright red and people understand it's probably time to sort of, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Like
one has to swallow the anger
I'm a tad bit emotional, like as a person. so I can get emotional without the cursing.
Yes. You've got cursers and you've got throwers, I think. The people that don't curse tend to sort of throw large, heavy objects at people. That's just as good. So maybe I can change the question. If you're not a cursor, what's your favorite object to hurl at someone?
Yeah. Well, you know, I like getting the Nerf guns and shooting my kids.
Yeah. That is a good weekend's entertainment.
Yeah.
Number eight, what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
So there's other asset classes I'd like to delve into at some point. Development of industrial parks. is one that I'm really kind of intrigued with and looking to do in the near future.
Oh, brilliant. Question number 9, what profession would you not like to attempt?
Anything that's small, anything that's solopreneur, anything where I can't scale.
And my final question, number 10, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
You served me well.
Well, that's a perfect answer. And my final question is, how do people get hold of you? How do they find out more? How do they get to hold of your books and you know, learn more about this fascinating enterprise that you've created?
Yeah, so they can go to Amazon and look up Martin Signs, and they'll find all the books there. They can reach out to martin@bqfunds.com, and I'll have one of the team members send out an ebook for BQuest Funds. They can go to Note Investing Made Easier and learn about some of the mastermind classes. That would be great for
anyone.
There's
me pronouncing your name Martin Sains all the way through. So there's,
Oh, that's all right.
To assume is to make an ass out of you and me. There you are. Point proven. Martin, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure. And we'll put all of those links on the website. And, it's been, brilliant having you on. And, I can't wait to, stay in touch and, follow your progress.
Thank you so much, Matthew. Thank you.
And cut.